Last semester we began, this is how far we've gone, we began with the 46th chapter of Alma. And I said that had everything in it. If there was nothing else in the Book of Mormon than that, it would prove the Book of Mormon would give us enough nourishment to go on to the end of time. This is just as good. This chapter contains more historical wisdom in the smallest scope as you can ever get it. That's a bad sentence, isn't it? More than you'll find in any other... It's the most concentrated form of historical wisdom. It tells us everything. The whole story is right in this chapter. And especially it applies to us. So, is Brother Barrows here? Brother Barrows? Let's read this first verse first. And then I'm going to ask you why this is a good place to begin. Now, it came to pass that the people of the Nephites did all return to their own lands. You see what? Well, you'll see it. In the 26th year, note the date, 26th year, every man with his family, his flocks and his herds, his horses and his cattle, and all things whatsoever did belong to them. Now, why is that a good place to begin a story? Now the people of Nephites did all return to their own lands. It ends one phase, it ends the war. It's the end of an epic, we begin a new phase. It's exactly the way the Odyssey begins. En thaloi men pontus aper fugin oikon alethron oikoi son. Polamunda pefugimus aetheth alas. And now all those who were to be spared destruction had got home, having safely escaped the perils of war and the sea. So he's going to begin. That's the way the Iliad begins. You see, you have this long epic, the Odyssey, and you go through all this wars and trouble. Then it says, now we're going to begin a new story. It's a new ending, a new beginning, and everybody's safely home. Everybody takes a deep breath. It's by very nature a new beginning. It's a good place to begin, isn't it, after the war and so forth. And look how much is in there. Notice the 21st, but I'm caught on one thing before I can go any further. You've got to explain something to me. Brother Bentil? Bentil? Kofi Bentil? See, this is an underhanded way of taking the role. Sister Bergerson? Shall I tell you? See, I don't call roles, so... Brother Bowen? Or Bowen? Good Welsh name. See, this is what I mean. Brother Burdett. Yes. Brother Burdett, you're here. Good for you. Now, look. The, what about this business of horses?
Sorry, what?
What about this business of horses in the Book of Mormon? Has that raised any problems?
It has, according to some of the archaeological scholars.
We can't get any further until we've taken care of horses then, because this is the main crux. This is the strongest argument, supposedly, that's been raised against the Book of Mormon. What about these horses it's talking about here? What's the objection? Why shouldn't they talk about horses? Incidentally, here again, this also introduces us to another thing. How we interpret the words, you see. If you're going to be literal, according to this, every male over the age of 20 owned more than one horse. It says every man returned to his horses. Well, what that means, every man, such as they were, returned to as many horses as he had, such as they were, you see. This is that it all returned. Every man with his family and his horses. Notice the use of, it's generic. See, all the men returned, whatever men there were that had horses, returned to whatever horses they had. See, this is generic, as it tells us, because it's the indefinite whatsoever. Whatsoever man had, whatsoever horses, returned to whatsoever horses he had. Yes, sir, brother.
I'm sorry, I don't know
where. Oh, we begin with the sixth chapter of 3rd Nephi. And fittingly, we begin with the third verse, where the bard takes a deep breath, it's an epic, and begins another phase of the story entirely. New beginning, happy, not a happy ending, but a definite ending to the war. Everything is settled down. Everybody's back home. Everybody's happy. They've returned to their farms. Now we expect a glorious period. Well, we're going to run ahead. And, we go on. We've got to get rid of these horses business, though, because this worries us, doesn't it? Is there any evidence that Indians has horses? Well, sure, they were. They rode horses all over the plains, but when and where did they get those horses? Well, nobody knows, as a matter of fact. But first of all, what about horses in Egypt? We know they had them in the New Kingdom because we have pictures of them and so forth. But if you go look for horses' bones, you'll never find any. No evidence of that sort. And the classic example, of course, is the camel. Professor Albright, who is the foremost American biblical scholar that ever was, absolutely insisted that people in Abraham's day didn't have camels. Camel wasn't written until the 11th century. There were no camels. But let's ask somebody here. Brother Burdett, well, I asked you something already. Where do you read about camels in the Bible? Do you remember who rides camels? Remember who has riding away on the camels, and she has the icon hidden under the camel's saddle and so forth? It goes back to the patriarchal romances. You know, that's the story of Isaac and Rebecca. That's Rebecca at the well, isn't it? Isaac and... what's her name?
Rachel,
of course. Rachel. In the time of Abraham. You see, in Abraham, he places us, say, 1800, 2000 BC, way back there. In other words, the patriarchal narratives talk, everybody's riding around in camels in the patriarchal narratives. Yet, the best scholars say they didn't have camels. There's no evidence that they had camels. There were no camels. All we have is the written record. But the written record is quite adequate, isn't it? Where'd they get the idea of their having camels and riding around in them and so forth? All it takes, you see, is just one piece of evidence, and that changes the whole picture. So you're not going to prove anything by... not going to prove a negative by the absence of something as far as that goes. But these horses, did every man have a horse here? Sister Burton. Sister Burton here? Yes, I mean. And Brother Buss?
Yes.
Brother Buss. What kind of horses do you find in America in the early days? The fossil horse. It began in America, didn't it? It was an Aeohippus, a little tiny thing, not much bigger than the jackrabbit. They wouldn't have ridden those around, so we make jokes about that. But what about the intervening phases? What's missing? There are all sorts of big gaps in it. See, what could have been there and what couldn't? It's very hard to determine these things. It was J.B.S. Haldane, the great British biologist, who said that the evolution of the horse is more certain than the proof of the Pythagorean theorem. It's more certain than any mathematical demonstration. It's absolutely certain. Since he said that, of course, it's been shown the evidence, the descent of the horse is as full of holes as anything. There's no unbroken record whatever to be established. But this is where it goes. But then when horses come, the Indians are the greatest riders that were, the Plains Indians. Well, do you learn to ride? Do people change customs overnight? Is Brother Call here? Yes, now a custom like riding, is that acquired readily and quickly by people? I'm talking about the various things that... H.G. Wells wrote a story with his great historical imagination telling exactly how man first domesticated the horse. Primitive man was hanging from a bough and a horse ran under him and he let go and fell on his back and was riding him. So he became a rider. But we know from Mesopotamian records, which are very ample, that men drove horses in the Shibboleth horse, the Central Asian horse, drove horses as teams, even as quadrigas, as four-horse teams, for 1,000 years before anybody ever rode them. They never rode horses, they drove them. They had them pull wagons, that's so. Well, why do people not take advantage of those things? And so, well, look at us. Have you ever ridden a buffalo? Ride a Cape buffalo, or the very close cousin of the Cape buffalo? The Cape buffalo is supposed to be the most ferocious animal in the world. We don't ride buffaloes at all, but in Southeast Asia, little boys ride them. Naked little boys with sticks ride them all over, and the great beasts obey what they want them to do. We'd never dream of doing a thing like that. After all these thousands of years, we've known that we could exploit our cattle by riding them, but we don't. Other people will never ride a horse. Another thing, you would say that there's definite proof that the Arabs never knew the wheel, because they never ride wheeled vehicles. They don't ride it at all. They've known the wheel for thousands of years, but you won't find them using wheeled vehicles. They ride, but they don't. In fact, they're suspicious. They say that when the bicycles first started being used, they wouldn't touch them. They were forbidden, because they say the dulab, that is the back wheel, the front wheel, was driven by the iblis. The devil made the front wheel go, but you make the back wheel go. So you're cooperating with the devil when you ride a bicycle, so they wouldn't ride bicycles. No, but the thing is, through thousands of years, the Arabs have never been found using wheeled vehicles, so they knew all about them. They had wheels, they were practical and so forth. Well, Flinders Petrie, the Egyptologist, father of Egyptian archaeology, pointed that out. These The Egyptians had certain inventions, and they knew their neighbors had them, but they never adopted those conveniences, and the other way around. The neighbors never adopted their conveniences, and they worked very well on both sides. It's a very strange prejudice we have about these things. Now, my friend Woodrow Borah at Berkeley studied years the horse in America. Do you know where the Great Horse Exchange Center was in New Mexico? Anybody here? Well, we got just a call. Is Brother Clausen here? Brother Clausen, yes. Where did the Spanish and the Indians used to buy and exchange their horses? In New Mexico, a well-known place beginning with Santa. Not a long word after that. It's just Santa and then Fay.
Hi, there's a full class of students over in the other building.
Tell them to come over here. Okay. They sent them over there. Well, that's 2 years old, that, and we never had a meeting in that room.
The class schedule says that.
Oh, isn't that typical? That thing was outdated 2 years ago, and they still send them to that over the Iron Building. Well, I guess we've got to start all over again, then, where till they come here. She said there's a full class over there. Two classes? One. This is going to be something, you know. We got too many here now. Well, that's all right. That's what I was expecting there. Brother McNeely, didn't you post up that thing on the wall?
I did.
You did? They just didn't? Oh, boy. Well, thank you very much. We posted up a notice that the class was here and not there on that board, but they're all over there. This is the word because the book said they were there. Santa Fe was the place where they traded the horses. But the interesting thing is, those horses didn't come from Mexico. They weren't Spanish horses. They didn't come from Mexico. They were going into Mexico from Santa Fe, and they all came from the plains. But that was in the 16th century, when the Spanish hadn't even been here before. So they were bringing the horses were coming down. And what's more, as I say, these customs are never adopted, riding and driving and so forth. People are extremely conservative in those things. And yet, we find the Indians the best bareback riders in the world. I just have to see a horse and off they go. We're told when the horse appeared down in Peru and in Mexico, in the Incan Empire, people were terrified. They'd never seen a horse. They ran away. Well, why didn't the Plains Indians run away from the horse? Why didn't the other Indians in Florida and so forth run away from the horse? They didn't. There's no sign of their being even impressed by horses. They were far better riders than the Spanish. They knew all about it. So there are all sorts of blanks, all sorts of holes we know nothing about here. You can't make an open and shut case of the horse at all. And the moral is, of course, the problem isn't solved yet. And you can't prove a negative. So this shouldn't slow us down. We should go right on here. But when you see horses, people will immediately call you up on that, you see. But again, you can see that the language is used very generally here. There's much more we could say about horses, but this isn't it's not necessary now. Well, and notice, nice things were going on here, and they hadn't used up all their food yet. Let's see what we have here. I just wrote seeing. Now, they hadn't used up all their food yet, therefore they had plenty to go on. They had a 7-year supply. They didn't need a 7-year supply. And they did return to their own lands. This is a happy ending, you see. Enthautum en panis seper, fugin orcan lethen oikois. And every man had gone back to his own home. Everyone who had escaped death, of course. Others didn't. They went back to their own lands and their own possessions, both in the north and the south, both in the land northward and the land southward. It's there. And so everybody happy and an ending again. Now, what makes that introduction particularly, we haven't got it down here, particularly appropriate for the present moment in history? This is a good one. Brother Clay, why is this happy beginning, a new era? All of a sudden, things are peaceful. After 14, 50 years of war, they had a terrible time. And all of a sudden, there's a whole area at peace. The north, the south, everybody's back home, everybody's happy. How does that remind you of something that's happening today? And how broad a hint do I have to give? Well, you refer to it exactly, of course. It looks all of a sudden as if everything was going to be lovely, doesn't it? And you know it does. This is very it's another turnaround. It's a good thing. Everybody's much happier than they were. A new opportunity, a new chance, a new leaf. That's why I called your attention to the year, to 26 here, because if we turn to, where have we got it? The same chapter, within the same chapter, see? In the, all you have to do is go to the 17th verse here. Notice verse 17, we're getting ahead of time. What year was this? The 30th year. Now we're going to have a little mathematics. Brother Clayton? Brother Clayton's here? Yeah. The 30th year, the story began, the happy story began in the 26th year. Now we come to the 30th year. Now how many years between? Brother Clayton? Get up. We don't use slide rules anymore, but have you got a computer with you? In the 26th year, everything was hunky-dory. Remember how the... This is exactly how a Gilbert and Sullivan comedy ends. You mean, it'd go this way. Oh, joy, oh, rapture unforeseen. The cloudless skies are now serene. Everybody's happy. It's a happy ending. This was a happy ending. So in this year, they begin with a happy ending. But how long does it last? Notice this 17th verse here. To the 26th to the 30th year is how many years? Four. And what happens? Look at the last sentence. They were in a state of awful wickedness. Took them just 4 years for the whole thing to collapse. Oy, oy, oy. Should that be a warning for anyone? You see, this is a very rich chapter. This is going to tell us why it happened, exactly how, the process, everything else. It's going to be all laid out for us here. It's a marvelous thing. Now, let me see. We've got to get it somewhere here. So, that was Brother Clayton, who did the calculating for us, wasn't he? Yes. So, now we come to the next one, and that is, how do the liberal policy... Oh, incidentally, we should ask you this. Sister Cox, is Sister Cox here? She was... You. Oh, Sister Cox. Do you remember what... Have you read the Book of Mormon up to this point?
Have I?
Yes. Oh, great. Now, what were Moroni's policies toward the enemy and the opposition? Was he a get-even man?
No.
Never, no. He always called them his brethren. The minute they showed any signs of weakening, he would immediately want to parley and discuss things. But the funniest thing was that after the war was over, what did he do? Throw them all into concentration camps? Make them pay enormous indemnities? No. He was a very wise man. He took their word for it and let him go home. And that was that. This happens time and again. And you notice that's a wise policy, and this policy is going to make for prosperity here. Because notice they go back and they're going to be very generous with the opposition. Notice we talk about the robbers here. It was the war of the robbers, like the Roman robbers, or the third verse here, how they treated them. Notice the third, fourth, and fifth verse describe their liberal policies here. Remember after World War I, Brother Darrow. Is Brother Darrow here? Yes, now, after World War I, recall the Treaty of Versailles, the League of Nations, and so forth. Well, that's too bad. Of course, I was there as far as that goes. Well, no. Just a couple of years after that, I was there on my mission, and the tension was terrible. It was awful. It didn't settle anything, because what happened? The French were determined to make the Germans pay for the whole war. They caused it. They were going to pay for it. And old Clemenceau wouldn't move. He wouldn't budge. And Wilson's League of Nations was adopted by everyone. The U.S. Senate turned it down. So that collapsed. And so the English and the French, especially the French, were going to get the last pound of flesh from the Germans. And what did it lead to? I'll give you 10 guesses. Brother Davenport? Sister Davenport. Excuse me. That's Davenport.
World War II?
Ah, you guessed. After World War I comes World War II. But it was that. It was that. See, the Germans were strapped. They were desperate, and it got desperater and desperater. And that happened, so that's not wise. But as Sister Davenport, after World War II, was it the same sort of settlement? Were we just as hard on the Germans and Japanese? We said, you'll pay for every penny of this. Who were the people that reorganized the general plan for the European theater? What plan did we call it? The Marshall Plan by General Marshall, you see. And who was in charge in Japan? MacArthur. And he took a very liberal stand, you see. They regarded him as the image. He could have been absolute dictator, but he wouldn't do it. He wanted to restore along the democratic lines, as far as that goes, and gave them great freedom. And there was as little oppression as possible. He gave them what they wanted, and the Marshall Plan, of course, helped Europe out, including the Germans as well. And of course, the Germans and the Japanese were the ones that staged the miraculous comebacks, a much wiser settlement, and that's the kind of settlement they made after this war. And you see how it pays off here in these three verses. They granted unto these robbers, who were bad people, you see, but they'd entered into a covenant to keep the peace, have to trust them, the band who are desirous to remain Lamanites, lands according to their numbers. So they rehabilitate them, and there are no reprisals, and they give them lands to settle in, and they had formed their laws according to equity and justice. Well, if you don't have anything to worry about, it should all be happiness. It should all be peaches and cream. The cloudless skies are all seen. It tells us that very soon. There's no reason in the world why everything shouldn't work perfectly, because when you establish things in justice and equity, how rare that is, but when you can do that, what that amounts to, you see, is grace and truth, actually, grace, charity, equity, and truth and justice. Remember, the Lord is full of grace and truth. When you have those two, you have everything. So, naturally, what was the what result would you expect from that? Do you detect that in the next verse, Sister Day? Sister Day here? Hoo-hoo. If you, well, then, Sister Divot. And, Brother Freeby, see what I mean? Brother Frost? Ah, now Brother Frost. If you will look sharply, the next verse, verse 4, tells us how this plan worked out. What was the immediate result of this sensible solution? Prosperity, you bet. They began to rack spots, and it was a terrific boom, a post-war boom. It really went wild. Afraid it boomed too much, though. 20 and 6th and 7th year, that's see, their 2 years pass away. Great order in the land, that's fine. Had according to the laws, according to equity and justice. Well, yes. And now you see, this is the situation we're in today, we say. What will be the fly in the ointment here? People are sort of worried. On Saturday night, I was visited by one of the most eminent architects in Yugoslavia. He's a member of the church and very active. And he's very esteemed. He's making buildings in Kiev, projects in Kiev and Lithuania, all over the Russian area. And of course, he's Yugoslavian. In Zagreb there, he's the head of a large architectural firm. And he says, it's good. It's going to last for 5 years. He says, 5 years. But I corrected him. I said, no, 3 years, 4 years at most. But come back to it, 5 years might be it, because the 5 years seems to be a standard limit. When the saints went to Kirtland, the Lord Joseph Smith prophesied that they'd be good there for 5 years. We have the five-year rule. Here's what happens. It lasts 5 years, so hi-ho. Should we start worrying already? What are we going to do about these things? Start taking the Book of Mormon seriously is what we should do. See, now there was nothing in the land to hinder the people, cloudless skies all serene, from prospering. Aha, what's the fly in the ointment? Not that, is it economic, is it political and so forth, it's because what people are. If the people weren't damn fools, except they should fall into transgression, of course. Alas, we have human nature to face here, don't we? So from here on, you expect the happy ending may turn sour very soon, and we find that it does, you see. Just in the 30th year, they'd reach a state of awful wickedness. We want to know how that was possible. Well, now Brother Hales. Brother Hale's here. Listen, find out then. Fifth verse. This sixth verse is an interesting one, too. Is Brother Hansen here? Brother Hansen. The sixth verse tells us, the question is, the judges, they appoint judges. We know that the system of judges has superseded that of the kings and under Mosiah. And how would the appointing of judges ensure the peace? What's the threat here? Is the thing going to last and so forth? Notice, there's nothing to hear now. It was Gedoni and the judges, Lycaonius and those who had been appointed leaders, who had established this great peace, and it was the judges who established the peace. Why was it judges? Why wasn't it the king? 10 guesses, of course. They didn't have a king. It was the judges were the government. But why judges instead of the legislature? See, they had a lot of organizing to do. You see, the judges are permanent here. It is a life position with these people. And the judges are in, and everything comes back. Well, where does everything rest in the end? In this country, with the Supreme Court. They can invalidate an act of Congress if they declare it unconstitutional. All that they have to do. So in the end, it all rests with the nine old men, you see, and what their ideologies and philosophies are and so forth. Is that the most stable system in the world? Well, if you don't have good judges, if you don't have honest judges, you might as well close up shop. Where are you if the judge isn't honest, you see? And so you find, what is a common theme of the prophets in the Old Testament? That the judges are crooked, that they accept bribes, you see. This is Isaiah, Jeremiah, they talk about the easily bribed judges and so forth. Do we have any trouble with judges in the Book of Mormon? Did you ever hear of any corrupt judges there? Anybody know of a corrupt judge in the Book of Mormon? There are various people. Remember when these Gadianton robbers take over? Well, we'll see a lot more of that in the future, though. They certainly had them. Well, what about Abinadi? Who were the people who judged him? They were the judge, the high priests. And what about the Lord? What about Israel? Where did the ultimate responsibility rest in Israel? Of course, it rested with the people, but who were those with whom the Lord dealt? The scribes, the Pharisees, the doctors, and the lawyers. The Pharisees, the scribes, were the officials of the court, and the lawyers. And the judges were the high clergy. They were all the same, and they were the ones in the trial of Jesus. See, Caiaphas, who tried him, was the high priest, but he was the chief judge, too, condemned. So it's a system of judges, and if the judges are corrupt, what are you going to do? But these were good judges. And now I run into something else. There were the horses there. Now I run into a very suspicious word here in the sixth verse here, which I hadn't noticed before, so we might as well notice it now. See, every time you go through, you get taken up on things. I noticed it later on, but not here. Is Brother Hart here?
Yes.
Oh, two Brother Harts. Gus and Douglas. Douglas?
Right here.
You're Douglas. All right, begin with D. What's wrong with this name Laconius in the Book of Mormon? We've been having a lot of strange, exotic names here. Well, the other Brother Douglas. Another Douglas, Brother Hart. What's wrong with this name Laconius? Does it sound, well, we have Nephi and Lehi and Sam, and we have Abinadi, and we have Laman and Lemuel, the good old Semitic, good old Arabic, good old Egyptian names, and now suddenly like something like Laconius pops up. We have any Greek or Latin majors here. You say, well, that sounds very suspicious. That sounds very classical to me. Do you know who the Laconians were? When you hear Laconia, what does it mean? See, a few years ago, if you asked that in a high school class, half the class would know what it was. We don't know anything anymore. No, that's true. Laconius, that's part of that Southeast Asia, that Southeast Peloponnesus, southeast of the Peloponnesus. And you know where, Brother Hart, you know where the Peloponnesus is, don't you? Woo-hoo! The Peloponnesus, the island of Pelops. Well, it's the peninsula that hangs on to the south end of Greece, and it sticks out in the Mediterranean. Southeast portion is very rich in harbors. That's Laconia, very rich in harbors and great shipbuilding there. And in the time of Lehi, you've had this already in Book of Mormon classes, so Brother Harvey, or either of the Brother Harts can tell me, in the time of Lehi, who was the king of Egypt? Who was the pharaoh? It was the 26th dynasty, and it was Pharaoh Necho. Yes, Necho first, and it was a new dynasty that had been established in the Delta, and he was a great power broker, very powerful man, but he was being threatened by the Babylonians. And who was the king? Who was the king of the Jews who pulled off his shoes? Yes, you should guess this one at least. Nebuchadnezzar. He was threatened by Nebuchadnezzar, so he had a great land empire in conflict with another great land empire, and Necho thought his great advantage would be to cultivate a fleet. He had a fleet. And just at that time, there happened to be invented a great novelty that revolutionized sea warfare. It was the invention by the Cyrenians, by Cilicians, of the trireme. They invented the trireme. It's very efficient, very sleek, very fast, very powerful warship that nothing could match. And they were good, and that's where they made them, in Laconia and in Cilicia. And Necho, who was the king of Egypt, bought up the whole fleet, including the crews and everything else. But that had a good tradition for that, because he built his empire up, and he was ruling, economic empire and so forth, in Palestine at this time, by the power of his army, which was made up entirely of mercenaries, and the mercenaries are all Greeks. And Greece was swarming in Lehi's day with Greeks and Greek speaking people. For that matter, the Philistines were Greeks. Their language was very close. So here, the name Lycaonius. There were Lycaoniuses running all over Israel in the time of Lehi, is the point, you see. Because it's just the people you'd expect to be there. The shipbuilders, the sea people, lots of sailors might be called that, because they would come from Lycaonia, you see, and be running around. But these things we didn't know were going on, you see. All this that's going on underground, if we knew about these things, this wouldn't all look so strange. You see, all of a sudden he pops up with a name that is about as Jewish or about as Egyptian as John Smith, you see. But it belongs here, believe me. And one of the judges is a rather eminent name, you see. And this takes us to the subject, we'll deal with this separately later on, about race in the Book of Mormon, which is much more complicated than we thought. But let's get on here with this exciting chapter that goes on. So the people began to prosper and wax great, and it's a happy time, law, equity, and justice, nothing to hinder prospering except they should misbehave themselves. And the good judge, Lycaonius, appointed leaders that were competent, and there was peace in the land. And so what would you naturally expect them to engage in peace after a long and ruinous war? I'll give you 10 guesses. Brother Harvey? Brother Harvey, is he here? Brother Havens? Now what would you expect after a long ruinous war? What would we have to do in Panama now for the next few years? Great projects. Lots of chance for nice big fat contracts for construction and so forth. Corruption all over the place. That's exactly what happens, you see, here. But notice it says that. Isn't Joseph Smith shrewd to know all these things? He's got it all figured out. That kid, 23 years old, in the farm, he sits down and writes it all out, you know. And it came to pass, were many cities built anew, new cities, as a boom time, you see, flourishing, and many old cities repaired. There had to be lots of repairs, lots of reconstruction there. Inner cities, everything, not just destruction, but they've been neglected in a terrible war. Had to use all the resources for other things. And naturally, if you have a lot of cities, what do you have to have connecting them? There's some nice fat contracts there, too, aren't there? Brother Hillam? Oh, yes. Brother Hillam, what do you have to have connecting the cities? You can have airports, but they didn't have them then. But you can have highways, yes, and we do know they did have marvelous highways. We must remember in the 1820s, when this was written, in 29, nothing was known about the great highway system and so forth that you find in Central America. And it goes right up, you find the highways all over, from Mexico City, but especially in South America, as you know. They go right down the whole length of the Andes. There are these wonderful, these amazingly well-built highways. So they do have highways connecting them. That's from a later period, but they're built like the Roman roads. We know it was only very recently discovered that the great net of Roman roads in Gaul, for example, in France, are simply overlaid over much earlier roads, pre-Roman roads that go back 5,000-6,000 years, this road system, because people have to get from place to place and they take the closest. There is a new survey of England, photographic survey of England, showing the roads that go back to the 4th and 5th millenniums. That's the 4 and 5,000 BC in England. It had a wonderful road system. The Watling Street, the main road that ran up the whole center of England, almost as straight as an arrow, that was there already then. So it's an amazing thing, connecting these things. That's aside from the ley lines that the mystic people talk about today, connecting the sacred prehistoric megalithic centers. All sorts of things going on we don't know about here. But this is natural. This is what you'd expect. The highways cast up many roads which led from city to city and from land to land, from place to place, a regular system. And so the 28th year, well, that takes us 28th year, and we're just 2 years away, and the people had continual peace. It's hardly something to boast about for 2 years, is it? Even we could keep peace for 2 years, couldn't we? It came to pass in the 29th year there began to be some disputings among the people, and now we see where the trouble begins. What was the threat to this highly successful economy, and would it last? We saw. Would you have any ideas about this? What would make you suspicious, Brother Hillam, that things weren't all going to be perfect once you heard about this great post-war prosperity, this boom? You would raise an eyebrow and say, can it last? Why? What's wrong with a boom? What's wrong with everybody getting rich overnight? Anything wrong with that? We don't think so.
Well, it leads to corruption and things like you were talking about the previous.
Oh, but can't you avoid that? Well, the famous saying of Lord Acton, like power, like money corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Will money always corrupt? Who uses money to corrupt people, you see, and buy up armies and navies, popes and priests, kings and presidents, and rules with blood and horror? You know who? He uses money as implements, so this makes me very suspicious. Things are going to happen. So, Brother Hilton, we read next. We should take this, read the verses as they come, shouldn't we? There began to be some disputings among the people, and some were lifted up into pride and boastings. That's been the last main word of President Benson. Pride is a thing to beware of. Now, we get a false picture of pride, don't we? The idea, it's not necessarily pushing people off the sidewalk. Where does pride begin here? Brother Hilton, is Brother Hilton here? Yes. When I see pride, do I have to see somebody with long flowing robes and his nose in the air wearing a crown and something like that? Is that necessarily pride? That's one form of pride. Is there anything in Central American art from the jars and the vases and the murals and so forth? Have you seen, you've seen books of Central American art and that stuff? What would suggest pride in those? There's a very consistent feature. You recognize that type of art instantly, don't you? You know it's not classical Greek art with a line fault and still a gracia, don't you?
Oh, lots of gold.
There's gold in everything, for one thing. And they don't just wear gold, but what else do they wear? Right, they load themselves like a walking Christmas tree with feathers and all sorts of clinking and rattling and glittering garbage, you see. And then they parade themselves. The thing is, it's comical, you see. In Central America, they overdo it so. You see, whether it's in the man, whether it's on the man, or whether it's on the in the Popol Vuh, the illustrations of that, early man book. Yes, it shows them parading around, these grandees, with much too much hardware on. But it's a sign of pride, and it talks a great deal about the Book of Mormon, doesn't it? Of their precious apparel, their costly apparel. It doesn't say beautiful apparel ever, but it just says costly. That's the main thing. And of course, that's the only thing that interests us, is that it has the proper label on it. It's the proper jeans. Otherwise, the cost is what makes them great. But this is the way the people were. Pride and boastings because of their exceeding great riches. You see, there are various ways. Boasting, it doesn't mean you'd have to go and shout it from the housetops. There are various ways of which you can show it. I mean, look at the ads that say you have to own a Cadillac because it gives you prestige. It's a prestige car, and you let everybody know. That's what they tell us. Oh, there's some very good things. A good essay yesterday in the paper, I noticed, on the yuppie philosophy. It was to have good things, to have things not just expensive things, but having things of good quality that are immediately recognizable on site, a BMW, a Porsche. These things are forms of boasting, aren't they? Because they display, you don't have to spend that much for a car after all. You don't have to spend $50,000, $60,000 for a car, but people do. It can be easily, immediately spotted as such an object. It's a form of boasting is what it is. And the same thing with our labels on jeans and so forth, our fashionable, what do we say, design labels and things like that, and hats. You can size a person's wardrobe up when you see it and tote up the bill and decide exactly how much they spent on it. This happens, doesn't it? And we do that deliberately. We try to make it obvious that we're wearing a particular brand of this, that, or the other. So this, they're boasting because of their riches. See, they're boasting about their riches. They're making their riches obvious, and it becomes invidious comparison. You all know about, well, if you don't know, you certainly should. Is Brother Hooker here? Brother Hooker? Brother Houghton? David Houghton or Houghton? And Hutchings? Sister Hutchings? All right, Sister Hutchings. Now here, we talk, it gives us the kind of a culture they're had, and this is very important what follows. See, Joseph's not leaving anything out here. How can they keep up this sort of thing? What is the style of economy? What is it? We see what their lifestyle is, but what are they? Barbarians digging treasures out and adorning themselves with shells from the sea and so forth? Not a bit of it. This is a very sophisticated civilization. We're told that. Remember, the Lamanites have been taught how to write, and it boomed business by the Nephites, as far as that goes. So, the next we see what kind of a civilization would you call this one next, Sister Hutchings? Yes. Well, start reading first, 11th verse. This is the most important.
There were merchants and lawyers.
What would you say? Business and law were the big thing then, weren't they? There were merchants. It was a business civilization. And where you have business civilization, you're going to have legalism. You're going to have courts, and you can't do business without lawyers. You see, they get all the money, but you have to have them, or they won't let you stir. And this is part of it, you see. That was legalistic. Well, you're saying, well, isn't that a development of our own times? Isn't that rather characteristic of our own sophisticated civilization, where you have the markets as we do and so forth? Is this way they always did business? Yes, it is. See, this is a Byzantine civilization. It's a very ancient type. I would still ask Sister Hutchings, what was I going to say? Professor McCormick at Berkeley always used to ask the candidates the first question. He says, what do I have in mind? Many merchants, many lawyers, and many officers. And so the result is, of course, you're going to have wealth distributed accordingly. Some people are going to be very rich. It's a business civilization. That was a Byzantine civilization. Well, what I was going to ask is, what is the code word by which we designate such a civilization? A ritualist, materialistic civilization, the ancient one, you see. Remember, we talk about Zion, and in contrast to Zion, what is the world of the materialist? Babylon. Babylon the Great. See, that's Babylon. Eighth chapter of Revelations will describe what Babylon is. Babylon is the wealth and the prophets. They use that as a code word. It describes that because Babylon was just such a civilization. I said Byzantine because that's later, but this is the Babylonian. But Byzantine was very official. Everything was divided into ranks, and your particular office, you had a particular mark on your garment that you wore, how distinguished you were, and there were various ranks for every calling. It was very highly organized bureaucratic society, and those are very, very efficient and then turn out to be very inefficient. But they were divided according to ranks, you see. That's supposed to make for efficiency and so forth. And, of course, the ranks were judged, alas, not according to capacity or anything else, but according to riches. Do we do that? People try to do it according to riches, you know. We do that. Well, what about a corporation? Let's go on. Brother Ivans? Brother Ivans here? Yeah. Oh, Brother Ivans. Do riches count for anything in the distribution of rank in a big corporation? You say you're going to give rank from the top, from the chairman of the board right on down. Does their wealth have anything to do with their position in the corporation? Anything at all? Does it make any difference? Could a salesman be twice as rich as the chairman of the board? Fat chance, eh? That's not it. It is the riches that if he's, as you go up the ladder, you make more and more. That's taken for granted. This is the whole thing. The classification, they're sorted out according to either their income or the wealth they already have. Who is the gentleman that has this obsession with riches that ranks everybody in riches, gives us the 400, the 300, the 500 richest and so forth? Do you know who that is, Sister Ivans? Who is it? It's Malcolm who? Forbes. Malcolm Forbes. Of course, he makes a rather cult of wealth. It means everything to him. It's rank. I mean, who you admit and who you don't admit. You don't speak to certain people unless they're in a certain bracket, you see. And of course, the Romans formalized that too. Under Otho, Galba, first Galba, and then Otho, the Emperor Otho, who was a great big fat slob and enormously wealthy. He bought the empire. Didn't last him long, though. It cost him his life, don't worry. But he divided according to riches. If you didn't get 22,000 sesterces a year, you couldn't sit in certain places in the theater. And it was all according to the money you got. Yes, but... we haven't got to learning yet, you see. I'm going to ask you about the learning. What would learning have anything to do with it here? I had some really good questions here, but I'm not going to ask them. This strange equation, learning and riches. It used to be just the opposite. This is what it was when I was growing up. We'll say L stands for learning, equals. It's the very opposite. The more learned you are, the poorer you have to be. No, it was a luxury. It was a delight, and you were willing to forgo all sorts of things so you could spend your side doing these things that the world didn't consider particularly practical and wouldn't pay you for. As far as that goes, you didn't expect to get paid when you studied things, you know, like Aristotle, when he explains the Pythagorean theorem to a class, and one young fellow asked, well, what good is that going to do me? And he said, Aristotle said to the monitor, give that boy a quarter so he won't think he's wasting his time. But you have to do these things, and learning was a luxury which you were willing to pay a high price for. You were willing to starve for and go without things, all sorts of things, because of that enormous delight in learning. And it's just the opposite now. You won't turn a page unless they'll put it on the line how much you'll get for that. That's morbid. That's tragic, you see. This should never be, as far as that goes. So, as you say, there are chances, but is that character, I say, when I was young, this would be regarded as a monstrous perversion of values. But is it our standard today? Would you say it was? I would say it was. Well, let me see now. Have you got three Iversons? Was that Michelle or Tanya?
Tanya.
You're Tanya. Well then, do we tend to equate learning and riches today? Yeah, we say, why do you go to school? Because you make more money, as far as that goes. And Brother President Barrows of University of California, Berkeley, shocked the world when he made that announcement. He says, he was General Barrows, the one who had led the campaign up in northern Russia after World War I. And the only reason one goes to college is to increase his earning power. Terrible thing to say, yes? Oh, yeah, IBM. I mean MBA, IBM. Same thing. MBA. Yes, it was the MBA, obviously, Chances for Learning. I don't think it was particularly found learning or learning in the scriptures or anything like that. The idea is the chances. Now, they could learn what they wanted, but if you had the money, then you had the chance, you see, and you can be darn sure what kind of learning it was. And some were ignorant because of their poverty, and others did receive. Well, you wouldn't say that of Diogenes, would you? See, Diogenes was the wisest man in Greece, but also the poorest, after Alexander the Great had his interview with Diogenes in Athens. And you know the story of that interview, don't you, Brother Johansson? Yes, Brother Johansson here? Yoo-hoo. This is a dirty trick to call the wrong. I never do before. Brother Johnson? Yes. Brother Johnson, you know who Diogenes was, don't you, Brother Johnson? He was looking for what with his lamp going around? Well, I draw a blank. Amazing. Brother Jorgensen? Brother Jorgensen, now you should know. You should know who Diogenes was with his lamp. Who was he looking for? He was going around barefoot, a very poor man, had nothing, going around looking for, an honest man. That was what, in the Old Testament, called that a mystery. See, that's what Jeremiah does. When you break a pot or you do something, and this stands for something else. Well, that lamp stood for the searching, the light in the world, searching for an honest man. He went around searching for an honest man. And he lived in a tub. And they said he doesn't work hard enough. So he would roll his tub up and down the street busily during the day. And they said, what are you doing? Well, I'm rolling my tub. I'm being busy like everybody else, you see, because I had to do something. That's about as much sense as our business makes, you see. 90% of the things we do. But Alexander went and asked him when he'd taken Athens, he says, now, is there anything I can do for you? Because he's a great admirer of Diogenes. And you know what Diogenes said. Everybody, raise your hands, who know what Diogenes said to Alexander the Great. He says, anything I can give you, is there anything I can give you? And Diogenes said, yes, get out of the sun. He was sunning himself in his barrel, you see. And he says, please stand aside and let me get the sunlight. That was what he asked. But as they walked away, what Alexander said, according to the Callisthenes, was, if I wasn't Alexander, the one man I would choose to be is Diogenes. Because he doesn't take his cues from anybody else. He's himself. He doesn't have to... He's making fun of the other people doing the business, busy, busy, busy work. You see, he's rolling his barrel up and down the street to show that he's busy like everybody else, and he's accomplishing just as much as they are, as far as that goes. But he was seeking for wisdom. Well, here, this wisdom and learning, and some were ignorant because of their poverty, but you see, again, this the equation. But always until our own day, scholarship has always been considered a life of austerity. That's the hermetic standard, you see. Though they could have great wealth, they don't choose that. That's corrupting and so forth. No, they weren't all that way, were they? Some were lifted up. Do you have any gems here? Yes. Oh, well, I see the time is up now. We go to 10-2, don't we? Yeah, that's right. Well, we'll resume here, Andrew. Everybody above K better be here the next time, too.